Now that we've moved the people, although the redditions are dead, I know that distance is not a matter of geography. Anyway, it's such a pleasure to have Loretta Ross with us. This is the third in the series that Nancy Hirschman and I have been organizing this year. And the next one is Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a legal theorist, who's coming from UCLA Law School, and she's going to talk on April 15th. So save April 15th at probably 4:30, although it's either 2:30 or 4:30. And the place of the center will be announced. Loretta has been for the last several years the director of the Center for Democratic Renewal, which is an organization that monitors the Klan in Atlanta. And before that, she was head of the Women of Color program for NOW, and was also a program director for the National Black Women's Health Project. She has done so many different things in her life, and as a matter of ongoing responsibility on the board of Sister Love, of a group that is concerned with men who batter, which there are about five or seven foundations, but she doesn't just play a nominal role, but is a very active administrator in those programs. This is a lady who has really been around. She also, in her non-existent spare time, writes. And she's just done an essay, which I'm sure she'll talk from, in a book that's just come out called Theorizing Black Feminism, which is published by Routledge. And it's an essay on African-American women and abortion, which is now in the process of becoming a book. But this is not the only issue on which Loretta has been writing. She's written a lot of wonderful issues, including on Women in the Klan, in which the title of which is
Sisterhood in Sheets.
Sisterhood in Sheets, and a whole series of other issues that are now in article form that probably we could get from you by writing to the center. It's just such a pleasure to have had her all day and to have her now. So we will.
I don't know why it's such a pleasure to have me, because all I've done is moan about your weather. You know, I left 70 degrees and magnolias blooming to come to Cornell, but obviously you have something worth coming here for, and that's the chance to talk to people who don't necessarily know what we do down south in terms of fighting the Klan and working on women's issues, so I'm glad to be here. The title of my talk is Black Women and Abortion, and I think I'm going to start it with the way that we pioneered it at the National Black Women's Health Project. One of the things that we value at the project is that every woman has a story to tell if only somebody would listen. And we really feel that. And I have to start with my own story for you to understand why did I write about black women and abortion. When I was 15 years old, I was in the 11th grade of high school. I really thought I was tough stuff at the time, because I was commander of our high school drill team, I was in the band, I was in the honor society, and these were all pretty significant accomplishments, because I was one of 50 black kids at a white high school with 1,500 students. And so we kind of felt that we were bad stuff, you know, because we were that talented 10th that was out there as role models for the rest of the class. But what happened to me is something that was not unusual of the day and age. This, again, was the 1960s. And what happened to me was that I became sexually active in a time when there was massive sexual ignorance out there. I didn't even know that having sex made you pregnant, much less the whole process. So I became sexually active, and perforce I became pregnant. I think I was fertile myrtle, because I only had sex three times and I was pregnant. It wasn't like, you know, I got a chance to really get off or anything. But anyway, my high school decided that it would implement its longstanding policy of expelling girls who were pregnant, as if, you know, us hanging around would contaminate the other girls or something like that. I tried to explain to them I didn't get pregnant from hanging out with girls, you know, but they didn't want to hear that. They really wanted to put me out of school. And while I didn't know about sex, I at the time, I realized I was pretty much of a fighter because I began to fight my high school for the right to return to school after I had my baby. And by the way, let me explain how this policy worked. Even though abortion was very much illegal at the time, the white girls who got pregnant went to Mexico or went to Europe or came to New York and had abortions. It was only the black girls who did not have those options that had their babies that were expelled. So this is Southern Texas at the time, and this is how it worked. So I wanted to be the one who had the baby, kept the baby, and then came back to school, and my high school was horrified because then they would have proof that all of their girls weren't sweet virgins on their way to graduation. And so we ended up having to sue the San Antonio Independent School System. We won the suit. By 1969, they totally had changed their policy, and girls were allowed to return back to school. Never any punishment of the fathers, by the way, in this process. And I think that was the moment I became a feminist, even though at the time I didn't define it as feminism. I just defined it as the right to go back to school, you know, because I was passionate about education. A couple of years later, even though my mother and father supported me through all of this fight with the school system, they never quite understood the sexual activity. Have any of y'all ever had that problem? And so a couple of years later, I was in college, and I was only 16 in college. And so you had to have your mother's or parents' permission to get birth control at the time. And my mother nor father would sign for me to get birth control. And I was like, wait a moment. I mean, I've got living proof that I'm sexually active. Your grandson's about a year old now. And I'm trying to prevent future pregnancies. And they said, well, you do that by abstinence. And I said, oh, yeah? So I ended up pregnant my freshman year in college, and I ended up having an abortion. And the way I had the abortion, because you also had to get your parents' signatures for that, was that I had my older sister fake my mother's signature on the consent forms. And that delayed the abortion, though, going through the process of finding the money to pay for it, because by this time I was living in Washington, D.C., where abortion was legal, but you still had to pay over $500 for it, and then you had to have this written consent form. And so I ended up having a very late second trimester abortion after I went through all of these processes, which was pretty bad, but I was glad it happened because I certainly didn't want to be 16 and a half and the mother of two children. One was bad enough. Well, after the abortion, my doctor said, okay, Loretta, you need birth control, and with or without your parents' permission, you're getting it, because obviously you're not going to stop messing around with those dangerous things called men. And so he gave me an IUD called the Dalcon Shield as a way to prevent pregnancies. He didn't know, and not a large part of the medical community at the time did not know, that the Dalcon Shield was a defective contraceptive device that led to sterility. Unfortunately, by the age of 23, I was sterilized from the Dalcon Shield. My tubes had ruptured and all of this other stuff. So by the time, and by the way, I had basically dropped out of college then, so I can't honestly say I stayed and went to school or anything. But by the age of 23, I kind of had everything that could happen to you reproductively happen. I mean, I had a pregnancy to full term, had a baby, had an abortion, and now I had a sterilization. And so I stopped fighting my life at that point. Even though I thought I was headed into a lot of other careers, I ended up becoming a professional feminist because my life was leading me that way. It wasn't like I didn't want to major in chemistry, which I did, or actually, I thought I was going to be into broadcast journalism at one point. I ended up being a feminist. So I say all of that to say that when I talk about the issue of black women and abortion, I cannot separate it from the things that have happened to me in my life. And I don't think it is appropriate to separate it either, because I know for a fact that the kind of things that happened to me happened to a lot of other women for a lot of the same reasons. And until those things stop happening to us, we always have to fight against them and fight to make sure that other women understand what is going on with them. Now, as an activist in the feminist movement or the reproductive rights movement, and particularly being black, one of the things that has constantly challenged me is this belief in the black community that, number one, we don't have abortions, number two, if we have them, we don't talk about them, and number three, it's genocide of the black race anyway. That those are basically the three myths that are thrown in your face every time you're trying to talk to them, to the community about reproductive rights. And so one of the things I committed to doing once I got a break from day-to-day organizing around the topic was to construct the history of black women's activism on reproductive rights. I instinctively knew that I wasn't the first. I mean, I think I'm original, but not that original, that somebody had thought about these things sometime before, that somewhere there was evidence that black women were concerned about these things before, but nobody had written the history. Because what I found is that, first of all, the black history that was dominant and available, and I was reading the Ivan Van Sertima and this and that and this and that, they absolutely neglected to look at this history through the eyes of black women. Then the white women were writing the history of reproductive rights and abortion, and Margaret Sanger didn't look at this experience through the eyes of black women. And then, I think most disappointingly, the black women at the time who were writing the history did not look at it through the prism of reproductive rights. If you can understand how all of those three things converge to say that there's a history here waiting to be written. Now, fortunately, in our community, we have a dynamic that helped me out, and that is sisters that help other sisters. And I was speaking at the University of Wisconsin a couple of years ago, pretty much like this, and the sister who was in charge of the African American Studies Department said, "Loretta, why don't you write this down?" And I said, "Write this down? I mean, you must be kidding. You know, if I could write it, who would listen to me? Because I don't have a PhD. I don't even have a BS. I mean, I have 2 years and dropout in terms of academic credentials." But this woman who edited that book, Stanley James, does a lot of work imbuing activists with the confidence that they can be scholars without the alphabet soup. And she was very, very instrumental in convincing me that this could be done, that I had lived a good 20 years of history, so I'm just writing down memory. And in fact, she showed me how you do library searches and call up books and just all the things that people take for granted in the academic world that can be really overwhelming obstacles if you're coming at it from an activist who barely can get a book out of the library. And so Stanley worked with me over a period of a year or so to write this history of black women and abortion. And that's what you see, the first manuscript is what you see there published in Theorizing Black Feminisms. I have sectioned the work off into both chronological periods and issue kind of periods. I have this outline in my hand that I'm developing. The first thing that I felt was important to write was the history of our use of abortion from slavery to 1970. Because there's this, again, denial that abortion has anything to do with our history. Back when we were proud slaves, we wouldn't have done such a thing, you know, kind of mythology out there that was very strong. And I should also add that I was also compelled by the fact of where I did my work. I was a proud black feminist who chose to work largely for my first 10 years in the movement in the black nationalist movement. You know, it would have been very easy for me to have left the black nationalist movement and totally immerse myself in the white feminist community and get support and validation. But part of my own orientation and background says that it's very important to work within groups like the Nation of Islam, within like the National Black United Front, et cetera, and to develop these concepts within that context so that it can be advanced from that end as well as the more normative place, like working with that within a NOW or even within the National Black Women's Health Project. So where I chose to place myself also had an impact on where I chose to start the history, because I wanted to show the connections through slavery, through the 1920s, et cetera, which are periods that are very important to those movements. The second major section, it deals with it from 1970 to 1990. That was the period when the whole picture changed, because you had the legalization of Roe in 1973, but by 1970, major states like California, New York, Washington, D.C., they had already legalized abortion. Roe was actually catching up to what had happened at the state level back then. And so that period was very important, and that's the period I define as the development of a black feminist consciousness. If you remember the stories, Barbara's written wonderful stuff, and Barbara Smith, But Some of Us Are Brave, Homegirls, But Some of Us Are Brave, or All the Men Were White, whatever that title is, you know what I'm talking about? Does anybody have the title of that book for me?
All the Blacks Are Men, All the Men Are White.
Yes, that's it. All the Blacks Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, whatever. I'll never get it right. But anyway, there's a green cover. I mentioned it because it was really, I mean, when I was developing my feminist consciousness, it was very few books out there. There was Barbara, and then we had to wait another 10 years till Bell Hooks wrote her book, and then we had to wait now, and you know, now we seem to have a wealth of stuff out there, so much so we can't even keep up with the reading of it all. But in the early 1970s, there was one book you carried around like a Bible, you know, and because it was the only one that was reflecting this emerging school of thought. And so in the 1970s, there was this whole distinct black feminist consciousness arising that had an impact on how we did reproductive rights struggle. So that's the focus of my second chapter. My third one is looking at it from a more political perspective, because I think one of the biggest challenges out there to the black feminist perspective around reproductive rights is this growing black conservative perspective around the use of black surrogates. Well, I call them black surrogates because all they are is parroting white conservative lines in blackface, you know, in terms of talking about, oh, well, you know, this is about family values and abortion is not a family value and blah, blah, blah kind of stuff. And so I'm looking at the rise of the black conservative movement and its impact on the abortion debate in the black community. And other chapters will look at new reproductive technologies and all of that. All of this is a book in process. I mean, I'm an excellent example of how difficult writing a book is when you're trying to work and keep from getting evicted at the same time. Because, you know, I work for a civil rights organization. You know, we miss one paycheck, and I'm down there at the homeless organization as a client. You know, so it's really important that we understand how this process works, but also to understand that anybody can do it, that you don't have to wait for some God on high to give you a piece of paper that says, okay, now you can write about your life and make it make sense and make it popular. So that's enough of the context. Let me get to some specifics. I don't think it would be an overstatement to say that birth control began in Africa. There have been things unearthed from the tombs, the Egyptian tombs, that look like condoms, that have been called condoms. The pessaries, which are vaginal suppositories that are inserted after sex as a way to prevent contraception. These have come from ancient societies, not only in Africa, but also in Greece and in Asia. And these are being found as relics now by archaeologists, and it takes a feminist to tell them what they were, because they just didn't get it. But, and so that when black women were bought here as slaves in the 1600s, they bought with them a lot of traditional knowledge around birth control and abortion that had basically remained intact for a large number of centuries. But what they found when they came to America was that this traditional knowledge wasn't treasured. In fact, it was forbidden for slaves to practice these things because it was very necessary to the slave economy that black women reproduce very rapidly, increasing the owner's wealth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so black women began to secretly, that's when the whole question of black women controlling their fertility began to go underground. After being in Africa, very normalized, very okay, I mean, I'm not saying African society was great or what should be romanticized because it did have some problems, but the whole question of women's biological functions was not mystified, was not something that was shameful. Or all of those things. Those kinds of associations and connotations did not happen until the encounter with European culture, even though the encounter with Arab culture was very brutal in its own way. But when we came to this country, we found that the use and the practice of birth control and abortion became an act of resistance against slavery. And because it was an act of resistance, often leading to death if you were discovered, it just encouraged the movement underground of this knowledge. As a matter of fact, I think Angela Davis in her book, Women, Race, and Class, has written quite a bit on the use of abortion, or at least the use of birth control as an act of resistance and what that meant. It was amongst the black midwives that were informally servicing the slaves that this knowledge was mostly passed, and fortunately the white doctors who were called in when whole plantation owners would complain that their slaves weren't having enough babies only began to learn about these practices that they were going on in about the mid-1850s. If you read my manuscript, you'll see that the first professional medical journals speaking of this problem were occurring about the 1850s when doctors were saying, well, some reason there's these black women are must have this secret that prevents the gestation of fetuses. And we don't know why, because as soon as they're out of this plantation, they suddenly become fertile. And so that's when it became apparent to the white slave-owning system that the slaves were not totally powerless in terms of their reproduction. Now, and I'm not saying that this was always the case. Certainly a lot of black women had children they did not plan on having, both coupling with other slaves and coupling with the slave masters. And that is largely because of the suppression of the information, that it was not widely available to everybody en masse, but that it was available to certain groups, I think, goes without stating. It can be proven. Historically, proof that in fact black women did want to control their fertility became immediately apparent after the Civil War, because within 20 years after the Civil War, black fertility was cut in half. Black women were having fewer and fewer children, some through abstinence, some through use of increasingly available birth control concoctions. For example, the development of quinine turned out to be very useful, not only for curing infections and malaria, but it also, when combined with Vaseline and a couple of other common herbal compounds, made an effective contraceptive. And so black women learned how to use quinine, and you know, because quinine and Vaseline you could get anywhere at the time, when before it was regulated like it is now. So that by the turn of the century, W.E.B. Du Bois, y'all familiar with him, one of the greatest black intellectual thinkers I think that we've ever seen, he's the guy that gave us the line that the problem of the 20th century will be the color line. And now that we're ending the 20th century, isn't it still the color line? But anyway, W.E.B. Du Bois did a study of black women's fertility back in 1915. And one of the things he discovered was that half of all adult black women had no children by that time. More than that, the whole age at which black women were getting married was increasingly shifting upward. And so they were delaying marriages, they were delaying sexual activity, but they were also increasing their use of birth control. This had become such a popular practice, popular meaning people wanted it, not popular like they talked about it, that by 1895, a black women's newspaper of the time called the Women's Era started running editorials saying, not all women are fit for motherhood. This is, you know, and then they went and talked about, you know, the virtues of being a childless woman and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this was a fairly vague allusion to the fact that within these black women's clubs that were very popular at the time, they were also talking about birth control or fertility regulation, but they couldn't say it openly. But what you found were allusions to it. For example, the black newspapers of the period used to advertise this product called Puff, you know, that was P-U-F, that was advertised, you know, as an over-the-counter thing you bought at your corner drugstore. And the tagline to Puff was, use Puff, end your calendar worries. Well, excuse me. The only time I was ever worried about the calendar was that certain time, you know what I mean? And yet, so they didn't openly say they were birth control devices, but anybody saying, use this in your calendar worries, isn't wondering about the summer equinox, you know? And so those were the kinds of allusions that you were able to find in the newspapers of the period. When Margaret Sanger came about in the early 20th century and started her drive for the legalization of birth control, maybe I should stop and back up. Before Margaret Sanger came about, in the 1870s, there was this serious drive by the government as well as conservative forces to remove birth control availability from the hands of all women. And in fact, a series of laws called Comstock laws were passed that prohibited the sharing of birth control information, that prohibited people knowing about how to control their fertility. It was also part of the drive to get this information solely in the hands of doctors as opposed to midwives and other people who were practicing medicine at the time. So Margaret Sanger's drive, 25 years or so after Comstock, was an attempt to again make birth control information widely available to women. And she started an organization called the Birth Control Federation of America that eventually turned into Planned Parenthood. Among black women, Margaret Sanger actually struck a responsive chord, particularly middle-class black women. And so beginning in about 1918 up to World War II, a lot of the black women's organizations of the time were sponsoring planned birth or Planned Parenthood kind of seminars, inviting not only Margaret Sanger to participate and come speak at them, but they were also involving very notable people like Adam Clayton Powell, who came to, you know, Harlem, a women's club in Harlem, to speak about the virtue of birth control and its use by black people. The dominant line in the black community around birth control in the early 1920s up until World War II was that the black race cannot progress if black people cannot control if and when they have children. That is seen as a p- part of the racial progress for black women to control their fertility, and it was seen as the antithesis to slavery when we had absolutely no control, so to speak, over our fertility and were forced to breed. And so that was the dominant line. Not the only line, but the dominant one. The second one that came to prominence was one that's probably most closely associated with Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. If y'all remember the Back to Africa movement that Marcus Garvey, an immigrant from Jamaica, started, and that was associated with the thought that in order to overcome the remnants of slavery and racism, black people need to multiply and just numerically overwhelm the white race kind of argument. That's a line that we still hear today, so it has still a lot of political currency today. But Garvey, for other reasons, was not the dominant black voice at the time. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of them, probably because he was also involved in the Niagara movement that led to the founding of the NAACP. He was seen as one of the real dominant voices. What you saw in the black newspapers of the period were not only ads for continuing ads for things called Puff and things like that, but you saw an ongoing debate over the question of birth control and abortion and the black community. At the same time, they would talk about how wonderful or how useful it was to the race struggle for women to control their own fertility. You would also read stories about them championing the causes of doctors who were arrested for performing illegal abortions. You know, Dr. So-and-so, George Shepherd, was arrested in Detroit in 1936 for performing an illegal abortion. How terrible it is. You know, we have too few black doctors, blah, blah, blah. He's only delivering a service that our women need. And yet, so you had that promotion. At the same time, you had within those newspapers a debate on what then was the eugenics policy of the country. Beginning in the 1920s, actually beginning before the 1920s, but becoming very popular by the 1920s, was this movement around racial purity and improving the genetic stock, not only for black people, but for all people. And the eugenics movement had as part of its belief system that the people we define as fit should be encouraged to breed, and the people we define as unfit should be discouraged from breeding. I mean, that was this basic thrust. And so people who they defined as fit, usually white and wealthy, were given incentives to have more children, where people defined as unfit, usually meaning poor, black, or immigrant, were given disincentives. The disincentives included absolutely criminal waves of sterilizations that took place amongst people who were in prison, among people who were mentally retarded, amongst people who literally had no political power and rights. And this whole mindset around the sterilizing of poor black women did not end until 1970s, when the Ralph case, y'all remember the Ralph case from the sisters from Alabama who were sterilized, and that all came to light. That whole process lasted for a good 50 years, which is why black women to this day have very strong concerns about sterilization abuse and the amount of it that still takes place in our society, but went along for so many years unchecked. And so at the same time, these black newspapers were promoting an individual woman's right to use contraceptions or to use birth control, they were also advocating against eugenics policies that tried to decide for whole populations of people what they should do. That's the first time that I got a sense from the literature, and other scholars have seen this, in most notably Rosalind Pacheski in her book, Abortion and Women's Choice, I believe it's called, or the state and reproduction. You can tell I never get book titles right. But I remember the authors and never the titles. So So again, proof I'm an activist, not a scholar. Anyway, Roslyn did a whole work around what she called the dual value system, to want individual reproductive freedom while at the same time resisting state-sponsored campaigns that tried to tell women how they should or should not have children. That dual value system became very evident in the 1930s in the black community, and I think it still informs our discussions today around reproductive rights, that we are talking about the rights of individual women to make choices that make sense for them. At the same time, we are absolutely opposed to any government, anybody else, determining what is right for a woman to do. And that's really important. In terms of abortions, I alluded to earlier that the vast majority of abortions in America, not only in the black community, were obtained privately, secretly, from black abortion providers who were operating in the black community. And so it was quite popular for not only black women, but for white women to come into the black community and see a doctor who, you know, you could pay $50 to $100 to, and or not even a doctor, but to see a doctor or a partially trained medical person who would do the abortion for you privately and keep it a secret, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was the underground abortion providers, largely in the black community, that provided a lot of abortion services for a good portion of this country. And I'm not saying that there weren't white providers, but there was definitely a lot of women who went to Harlem, not for the jazz, but for the medical services they were getting there. Abortions from these providers, though, were fairly expensive. When you think that $50 is what they charged for an abortion in the 1930s, at a time when women were making less than $10 a week when they were workers, still meant that they were prohibitive, but women were prepared to go to any length to terminate the pregnancy. And proof of their desperation was evident from the kinds of things that I read about and then wrote about that women were using to stop pregnancy. For example, one of the most dangerous concoctions I can think of that they used was they would boil nails until they became rusty, and then they would drink the rust water, because this was rumored to cause such severe cramps that the cramps would be so violent that they would cause a spontaneous abortion and that would get rid of the fetus. Well, excuse me, but it also caused tetanus. And so a lot of people were dying in their desperation to stop the pregnancy. They would also take various poison compounds. Any compound that was guaranteed to cause severe stomach cramps, which is a lot of poisons, they would try to use diluted amounts of it to try to cause abortions. And so I really hesitated at repeating some of those formulas that I discovered, because I didn't want some young teenager getting a copy of this and trying this, you know, out of desperation. So I kind of kept the outlines kind of vague deliberately, because if you repeat some of those formulas, I'm just really afraid that somebody will get it and say, oh, let me get some rusty nails and try this. Because we are getting made possibly back to a point where people will have to try anything as our government increasingly limits the access women have to abortions. Not only our government, but the anti-abortion movement. One of the things that began to change in the 1940s, after World War II, up till about the 1960s in the Civil Rights Movement, was the rationale people used for arguing that the black population should be limited. Before, in the height of the eugenics movement, The rationale was that, well, we just need a better race of people. You know, we need the supermen, we need the fit people having more babies, et cetera, and the unfit having fewer. But in 1945, when they defeated Hitler, when this country and the Allies defeated Hitler, the whole question of eugenics had been largely discredited, that this whole super race theory just was not going to work anymore. But there was still a strong need, some felt, to control the population of non-white people, both around the world, but also specifically in this country. And so what we began to see the first evidence of was a resurrection of the theories of Malthus. I've forgotten what his first name was because I'm talking about him bad and I never remember his first name. But he, in the late 19th century, had put forth the theory basically that said that the planet cannot support the number of human beings on it, and that because of our limited capacity to produce food, to take care of the existing humankind, unless something dramatic and drastic was done to slow down the human reproduction rate, that the planet was going to be in dire straits. Well, after he first gave out his theories, there was a period when our technology, particularly our food-producing technology, caught up and passed the existing levels in which he was talking about. So people didn't give a lot of credence to that because we were developing the capacity to feed more and more and more people. So this whole Malthusian theory of, you know, starvation through overpopulation simply was not widely entertained. But now by the 1950s, what had begun to emerge was a resurrection of these theories, saying that it's not a question of our capacity to feed them, but it is a question of our capacity to govern them that makes it necessary to limit the populations of these people. And the U.S. was establishing itself as the dominant world governing power after World War II. And so that's when a whole series of new population theories came out, saying that, well, until these people in the third world and these people in the black and the Latina and the Asian community stop reproducing so much, that there's going to be total social chaos, et cetera. And so the whole question about America's military ability to govern the world became the rationale for resurrecting Malthusian theories, and a new form of eugenics came about. It was during this period that a lot of emphasis was put on trying to establish the use of what was sanctioned birth control by then, legal birth control in the black community. For example, the Birth Control Federation of America, which had become Planned Parenthood, started a Negro project that was directly aimed at the black community, that enlisted the aid of doctors and ministers and nurses to talk about the use of birth control, to promote the use of birth control in the black community. And it was, again, accepted like the two-edged sword it was by most of this recipient black community. Yes, we want control of our fertility, but no, we're not blind to your larger plan. I mean, not to ever forget those two things. By the 1960s, a new rationale for controlling the black population had come about, and that's when the whole question of controlling the black population became part of the war on poverty. Particularly the riots of the civil rights movement and the riots of the early 60s kind of gave impetus to this belief that if you don't control this rising inner city black population, America will be ungovernable. Now it's not the rest of the world will be ungovernable, we will be ungovernable. And so it's no coincidence, at least I don't think it was, that the same year we got the Voting Rights Act in 1965, we also got several million dollars from the federal government to start family planning clinics in the black community. And in fact, Congress created this arm called, this office called the Office of Economic Opportunity, OEO, and their first major investments in terms of health care for black Americans was in establishing family planning clinics all through the black community. And stuff, and again, as I said, black women being no fools, we knew exactly what was going on and were very clear. Again, it was no coincidence that people were getting free family planning under conditions in which they weren't getting basic health care. You know, that's no accident.